WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk right here at 95.9. WATD, and my name is Kevin Tachi. I will guide you through the nearly next 2 hours as we have the airwaves until 8 p.m., and we have a great show lined up for you, and I mean a great show. We'll kick the first hour off with, of course, the State House report. This week, joining us, State Representative Josh Cutler, representing the 6th Plymouth District, which is a precinct in Duxbury, Pembroke, and the town of Hanson. We'll chat with him about some of his committee assignments and even get the details on his summer social that's going to be coming up, I want to say in about a week. We'll get the details from him, some of the folks who are going to be appearing at that in-person event. I think it might be the first one of the season, the first one in some time for the representative. So we'll get details on that. Following the representative is premier sponsor of Monday Night Talk. Richard Rosen will stop by. We'll get an update from him in regards to his two establishments, McGuigan's Pub and the patio at McGuigan's. And he's going to share some updates as to what's happening over at McGuigan's. I believe there's going to be some updates to the facility itself. So we'll get those details from Richard. Our number two, we will speak with former state representative Jeff Deal, who is now a Republican gubernatorial candidate. We'll get Jeff's take about running for governor, hoping you can get the Republican nod for the party and what some of the key issues are in that particular race. So we look forward to talking with him about that. And then we'll close things out with Mike Festa. He is the AARP Massachusetts State Director. Oddly enough, I believe that Mike is a former state representative here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, but he's not here to talk about his political past. He's actually going to talk to us about a study that was done that documents the final strain on family caregivers. And I believe we're going to get the details about a federal credit caring act that could net somebody, an individual who is eligible, tax credits up to $5,000. And I believe this has some widespread support, and there are many organizations that are signing on and backing this. So we'll talk with Mike about that in just a couple of moments. But right now we are going to turn our attention to the roadways one final time this evening, being brought to you by Brennan's Smoke Shop, online at brennansmokeshop.com. Don't forget there are locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and drumroll please, Hudson, New Hampshire.
Well, thanks, Kevin. I love being after the drum roll. The expressway northbound is inching along from the Braintree split up to a crash at Adams Street. Southbound is jammed from the tunnel down to Southampton Street. Then you're slow from Furnace Brook to the split. Route 3 South is in good shape from the expressway down through Plymouth. 93 North, that's now busy from Route 37 to the Braintree Split. That's because of that northbound crash on the expressway. And Route 24 south delays from 93 to the Horse Bridge. This report is sponsored by Whole Foods Market. Prime members at Whole Foods Market buy 2 12-packs of Waterloo Sparkling Waters and get one free through July 12th while supplies last. Learn more on the Whole Foods Market app. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm Lisa DiMilo in the WATD Traffic Center.
Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan's Smoke Shop. So Route 95, 93, and 495 all lead to tax-free New Hampshire. Oh, and don't forget Route 3 North. This is the direction you want to head towards Brennan's Smoke Shop, Hudson, New Hampshire. Yep, Route 3 North, exit 88. The last off-ramp in Taxachusetts. You get off the exit, head towards the Merrimack River, over the river and through the woods on Route 3A North we go to Brennan's Smoke Shop in tax-free Hudson, New Hampshire. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Customers must be 21 years of age or older, and proper ID is required. So what you're saying is It's very interesting that the tobacco consumers in Massachusetts paid for the roads that take them to tax-free Hudson, New Hampshire. Did you like that? That's good. Over the river and through the woods to Brennan Smoke Shop we go.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We want to thank you for keeping your radio dial set here at 95.9 WATD. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk, and it's the first segment, the State House Report. And first up, joining us is State Representative Josh Cutler. Representative, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on again. Yeah, it's been a little too long. We have lots to catch up on. It's been a busy time down on the South Shore and also up on Beacon Hill, both physically and virtually.
You know, the one thing that we're hearing
in person.
The one thing that we're hearing about more and more these days, you know, everybody's enjoying getting back to life and being able to hug and not wear a mask. But lurking right now is the Delta variant. Now, I know the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is in a good place because greater than 70% of our residents have gone and got vaccinated. Is this a conversation, you know, COVID reoccurring in the fall and winter? Is that something that the legislature or your colleagues in the House are talking about?
Yeah, so it's a concern, obviously. You know, all the variants, especially the Delta variant. I think it's a good time to sort of remind folks about the importance of getting vaccinated. You know, all the studies that I've seen, again, I'm no expert, you know, that the if you are vaccinated, it is very effective against the different variants. So I think that's a good reminder to all of us, you know, who still maybe are waiting on that. As folks probably know, the governor announced a plan of Vax Millions, basically a lottery system, as other states have done successfully, to encourage people to get vaccinated. And that is now in effect. Residents can enter starting this past July 1st. So it's now open. And there are $5 million prizes available and 5 college scholarships available, up to $300,000 for students. So some nice potential prizes there. So the Mass Vax Millions people, and anyone who's gotten a vaccination is eligible to enter. You can just go online and enter. It's not just for people who recently vaccinated. So anyone who's already vaccinated can enter that. And it's a way to, you know, try to highlight the importance and to reach people who may be a little bit more hesitant or reluctant to do so, because, you know, we know how important it is for the variants, but just in general, public health as well. So that the Mass Vax Millions that Governor Baker has proposed is now, that lottery is now in effect. And I believe the first drawing will be held beginning July 26th. And there'll be a period of 5 weeks ending in August 27th. So still time to enter and be eligible for a prize of up to $1 million. Or if you're under the age of 18, a college scholarship.
That's fantastic. And now, have you crossed paths with anybody who has been adamant about getting vaccinated? I mean, I have yet to, but, you know, I know that there are those people who are out there who, you know, will say conspiracy or I'm not doing that.
You know, I haven't really had a lot of that. I mean, I understand, you know, the people who have religious beliefs and maybe have some health concerns. And, you know, that's fair. I think there's also probably some people who just, you know, want to kind of make sure it's safe and I, you know, and seeing that everyone's got it and so forth. And I think we've reached the point where, you know, there's enough science out there that, you know, it is safe. And so I haven't seen a lot of that, though, Kevin, which is encouraging. And I would just encourage everyone to go out and get vaccinated. I think, it, you know, it is. We've seen importance. And with the variants, you know, we've seen some spikes in other areas. Massachusetts is doing a great job overall with the percentage. You know, we don't want to backtrack or backslide on that.
I know you and your colleagues, not only the House, but the Senate, were very diligent during COVID to make sure that if there were certain policies or ways to help residents or businesses, you're very, very proactive. And I believe that recently there was a move put on to extend some COVID policies. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we've seen, you know, I mean, the pandemic, you know, obviously was not something we welcomed, but there are some benefits to it, and that some policies that we put in place, you know, proved to be an improvement, you know, and obviously being able to do things virtually in many cases can be a benefit. It brings access to voices who may not be able to participate, or, you know, a whole measure of benefits. Some of those policies, we recently made some decisions to extend, even though the state of emergency has officially ended. One of those was the cocktails to go at local restaurants. That was something that proved very popular and helped to support our restaurant industry, you know, during a tough time. So that has been extended to May of 2022. We put in policy to cap third-party delivery fees, which were in some cases really exorbitant, and they were also charging restaurants a significant amount. And so we put in some reasonable caps on that so that there's no price gouging with third-party delivery fees. That was extended till spring of 2022 as well. Outdoor dining has proved to be a really big popular option in many cases. That's been extended, the flexibility there, through spring of 2022 as well. I know for our local town officials, having the option to do remote open meetings has been important. Some communities are choosing to go back to in-person ones. Some are choosing to do hybrid. Those are both great options, and we want to keep and preserve the ability of our local officials to make those kinds of decisions. So we did extend the remote open meeting flexibility to April of 2022. Also, similar for town meetings. You know, I recently was at Pembroke Town Meeting. It's town meeting season in the spring and summer, and we wanted to make some sure we have preserving flexibility for quorum adjustments. And so that was extended till the end of this year. And then one other thing, it's more niche in scope, but virtual notarizations, that's a concern for some folks who are trying to do, you know, different legal documents to have notarized. We extended the flexibility on virtual notarizations through the end of this year. So those are some of the policies that, you know, were well received and seem to be a net benefit during the pandemic. And so we want to continue with them. And, you know, we'll revisit those next when they do run out next spring and see if they're worth, you know, making on a more permanent basis. But this gives us more time to kind of live with them and see how things shake out. So that was some good news, I thought, to try to preserve some flexibility in those areas.
Aside from creating legislation and setting policy, I know that you serve on a few different commissions and committees. Any updates in any of those areas?
Yeah, it's been busy, Kevin. As you know, so I'm the House Chair of the Labor and Workforce Development Committee, which is a busy committee. And this has certainly been a busy time when we're, you know, looking at a lot of workplace issues, the future of work, and where is, you know, the workplace and the way how we work and where we work and so forth, and a lot of those kinds of questions. Also, you know, unemployment, that we know that has been a big issue the past year, sadly, with many folks needing to rely on unemployment benefits. You know, we've seen some improvement there. Both of those big topics kind of come under my committee. So it's been a busy time for us as we kind of grapple with and dive into those issues. And we have a couple of commissions, one on the long-term solvency of our unemployment insurance trust fund, trying to look at ways we can shore that up because we, you know, the COVID has really done a number on our UI trust fund. So trying to see how we can make sure that that's solvent for the long-term, because we know how important that is as a safety net for our residents and also the impact that it has on our business community. So that's been one big endeavor that I've been really involved with. I co-chair the commission. And the other one that we're doing now is a little more fun, I would say, on the future of work. There's a commission on the future of work that I'm co-chairing. And we just recently had our first meeting. We heard from some different experts about that. And that's sort of looking at sort of some of the broader issues here in Massachusetts as policymakers, you know, the nature of work, you know, putting aside COVID for a moment, the nature of work is changing, you know, and, you know, how can we adapt and adjust to those changes or in some cases maybe spur them on? And obviously COVID has accelerated that change in many ways. But looking at some of these future of work issues is one of the charges of this commission. And we have a great commission with about 17 members who are looking at that. And we had our first meeting, as I said. We'll be doing some, that was a virtual meeting. We'll be doing some further meetings in person. In fact, we're going to be bringing the commission down here to the South Shore in the fall. We're going to be hosting a commission hearing in Plymouth for the South Shore region for folks to weigh in and talk about some of these issues that, whether you're an employee, employer, or a small business, some of the things that people are seeing in terms of the nature of work and how we want to see and frame policy to encourage those kind of positive changes in the future. So that's been fun to hear and kind of look at some issues in terms of trying to look down the road a little bit to the future. We're actually going to be having a hearing soon up at MIT to kind of learn and talk about some of the tech issues with future of work. So that's been fun to dive into. So those are just a couple of things, Kevin, that we've been working on. There's obviously a lot of issues before Labor and Workforce Development Committee, and it's a pretty robust schedule, but I'm really enjoying my role and having opportunity to serve in this leadership position and on behalf of my constituents and the South Shore and give us a voice on these really important issues that affect the whole Commonwealth.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with the State Representative Josh Cutler as he represents at Duxbury, Pembroke, and Hanson, and not all of Duxbury, because we don't want to, you know, there's another representative who also takes up a portion of Duxbury. Now, anything you want to touch upon in regards to your district? I know that there was a successful vote to build a new community center in Pembroke. That's got to be some exciting news.
Yeah, that is exciting. Yeah, Pembroke approved at both the town meeting and at the town election funds for a new community center, which is something I've supported. I think it's a great project. It's really going to help to, I think, revitalize that area. There's an old school that's used as a community center now, and you know it's long past its useful life. And having a vibrant community center that will also serve as our senior center, I think is going to be great. It's going to be fantastic. I've seen, you know, and Duxbury has a fantastic senior center that it's called a senior center, but it's really a community center. I spent a lot of time there. I used to before COVID and now will be again. And it really brings the community together, and it's a nice multi-generational place for people to gather. And so I think this will be very similar in Pembroke, and I think it's going to be something really great to revitalize, you know, the whole town center area. So that's really exciting. And we had some, I know there's a gentleman named Andrew Sullivan who deserves a ton of kudos, who devoted a ton of his own time and resources to help foster this, and a good committee that was really involved working behind the scenes. And they did a good job. It's tough to get projects like that passed sometimes because there's a fiscal impact, but they made the case and the voters agreed. So that was, I was very pleased to see that. I think they'll be breaking ground later this year, hopefully.
We should take a moment to tip of the cap to Duxbury resident Megan Driscoll Greenstein, who I know she and her bill that she helped craft, or at least helped have put language in regards to wage equality, was before your committee, the Wage and Workforce Committee. Give me your thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, so yeah, that's that. I filed the bill, so I'm certainly supportive of that. Wage transparency is an issue that I think, you know, something that does benefit employers and employees. And the idea is, you know, when you have more transparency about wage ranges, everybody's on an equal footing. Historically, you know, women and people of color have been not paid as well as men. And one way to level that playing field is to have wage ranges more public, so that everyone can negotiate on an equal footing. And so our bill is fairly simple. It just would allow that businesses disclose a pay range, not a salary, a pay range for a given position upon request to an applicant or to a current employee. We've made big strides in Massachusetts. We passed a big gender pay equity bill, I want to say 3 years ago, I think it was 2017. And, you know, that was, that did a lot of positive things. This is sort of the next logical step to provide, to close that wage gap. And again, it's not just for women and people of color. I mean, I think everyone benefits when we have wage transparency, and when you're going in. And as an employer, you know, I can tell you as a former small business person, you know, the worst thing for me was when you have a position, you hire, you go through the hiring process, you find a good candidate, you get to that second interview, okay, it sounds great, and then you realize, hey, this person had a totally different salary expectation than what we can do. And so that time, you know, is sort of wasted in a sense. And so having a clear sense of that going in, what the wage expectation is, I think puts everybody on an equal footing. And you kind of know that going in so you can make your decisions and negotiate or make your make any changes that you might want. So that's something that we've worked on quite a bit. And Megan has been a great, great ally for that. And we have some good support from both labor and the business community. And we just recently had a hearing before my committee, which was went well, as you might expect. And we're continuing to work on that and trying to you know, iron all the details out and hopefully move ahead with that that bill. So
just, have a couple of minutes left in our conversation here, but I wanted to at least take a couple of minutes to recognize that the Cutler Committee is about to have one of its first in-person events sometime. I believe this is taking place over at Christina's Restaurant in Pembroke, and it's going to be taking place on July 19th. Give us the details.
Yeah, no, it's Kevin. It's nice. You know, we've done some virtual events over the last year, but it's nice to be able to in general, just to see people in person. I just came back from a little coffee meeting at the local coffee shop. And, you know, it was nice to, you forget how much you miss that kind of thing, just being able to talk to a constituent or different folks in person. It's nice with the virtual, but you definitely lose something in transition. But in any case, we're doing our first in-person event in quite some time at Christina's Restaurant over in Pembroke, just a sort of summer social event. That's a great restaurant. If people aren't familiar with Christina's in Pembroke, Jim and his wife, they do a fantastic job. And so we're doing it's just a very informal social hour over there on the 19th. So looking forward to seeing people in person and having a chance to hang out in person and talk to folks again. I think that's we've all missed that a little bit.
I think you're burying the lead here, though. I understand that you got some fantastic entertainment and some special guests who are going.
I forgot. Yes, you're right. I'm burying. So, you know, we have our esteemed MC. I shouldn't forget our good friend and who does a great job for Plymouth County Treasurer Tom O'Brien, who's done such a fantastic job administering the CARES Act funding to benefit all of our towns here in Plymouth County and with ARPA funding as well. A good, great elected official and great friend, Tom O'Brien, will be MC. And we have some music, Sean McLaughlin, local musician. And so, yes, you're right. Thank you. What do I do without you, Kevin?
I know that many of the county officials tune into the show. And
I would have been committed a big faux pas if I had forgotten to do that, to mention that. And we thank our county officials always, but especially, you know, the last 2 years of all the work that they've done. I can tell you to administer the CARES Act funding, the amount of money that's come back to our cities and towns, the three towns that I represent, but every town in Plymouth County and the city of Brockton have really benefited tremendously from that. And it really has helped make what would been a tough situation for our budget, local budget, local officials, has made it a heck of a lot easier. So we're really appreciative of all of that, their work on that.
And if there are any constituents who are tuned in and want to reach out to you or they want to speak to your office, what's the best way for them to stay on top of some of the things that you and your office are doing?
Yeah, so absolutely. So number one, I'm back to doing regular office hours in person at our local senior centers for folks who would like to come in person, but certainly still happy to do things via Zoom and virtually if people prefer to do that as well. excuse me, if people prefer to do that as well. Our website, joshkotler.com, or calling our state house office. People need help. We still do have many folks who are, you know, looking for assistance with unemployment related issues and other kinds of matters. So we're certainly, our staff is here to help. And feel free to reach out by phone, email, website, or in person. Any of those ways are all welcome.
He is Representative Josh Kotler, and he has been our guest. Thank you so much for joining us, Representative.
It's a pleasure, Kevin. Thank you.
We will step aside just for a moment, but upon our return, we'll speak with Richard Rosen. He is, of course, a local business owner of not one, but two establishments, and also a very proud sponsor of this radio program. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk. You're at 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
Buying, selling, or trading in a car? Learn from the experts how to make the process work for you. Tune into the Boss Auto Show every Saturday after the news at noon on 95.9 WATD.
Jay Farner here, CEO of Rocket Mortgage and Rocket Companies. Last year, we saw historically low mortgage interest rates. What you may not know is that interest rates are already starting to increase, and it's likely that trend is only going to continue. Our team of experts is standing by to help you save before rates go up. Don't look back and wish that you had taken action. Call 833-8-ROCKET or visit rocketmortgage.com.
Rocket. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states and MLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
This week's Pro Basketball Update brought to you by Credit Karma. We're into week two of the finals, and what a series it's been. East and West continue to collide, with Phoenix pushing the pace and Milwaukee playing that tough defense. Some experts say it could come down to which team can remain injury-free. The fans can't wait to see how it turns out. Right now, visit creditkarma.com/winmoney to open your free account and start winning instant karma. No purchase necessary. Exclusions and terms apply. See rules.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
I will say is what's great about this radio program is the people who not only tune in, but the folks who support it, whether it's coming on and being a guest on a regular basis or being a sponsor of this fine program. And talking about sponsors, one of our premier sponsors, McGuigan's Pub / The Patio at McGuigan's, Richard Rosen joins us from time to time, and he is our guest for this segment as we play a little catch-up as we cruise into the month of July. How are things for you, Mr. Rosen?
They're very good, Kevin. And how are you this evening?
Yeah, I'm taking it one day at a time. I'm surprised that we are where we're at when it comes to dealing with the pandemic and knowing it's, you know, you still got to check and see if you, do I need a mask to go into this place? But I feel as though life is returning to normal. Are you feeling that in your two establishments?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's very clear to me that people just want to go out. People want to go out. They want to have a good time. They want to be out amongst friends. And also what I'm finding in the restaurant business right now is that it's cheaper for people to go out to dinner than it is for family of two to stay home and cook. I mean, the prices of things from chicken wings to bacon to tips, pretty much across the board, the prices have gone crazy. But people are getting out. I'm still seeing people now, maybe a couple of times a week, that we haven't seen in over a year because they're just coming out. It's you know what? After what we've been through for the last, you know, year and a few months, it's almost kind of cool to sit here and say, you know, we survived, we've done okay. And to see people that are healthy and happy, just to be out and about, it's kind of neat. But yeah, I'm seeing it big time.
If I can ask you this, and I apologize if I've asked you before, but I feel as though we are on the other side of this. We've cleared the tunnel and we are in full daylight at this particular time. But when we were dealing with this back in April of 2020 and May of 2020, as an individual who owns multiple businesses and is very hands-on, did you, were there at times that you question yourself whether you'd be able to make it to this point and be fully intact as a business owner?
There were times that I'm saying, what the hell is going on? And are we going to be able to do it? I never questioned that we would make it. I prayed that nobody ever got sick. And you say we're out of it and beyond it. I'm still concerned about people that aren't getting vaccinated. I mean, that's a major concern, and it should be for everybody. I just read an article that all the people that died in one state last month, none of them were vaccinated. You know, we don't have polio. We don't have smallpox. People are going, oh, I'm not going to get the vaccine. I don't know what's in it. The vaccine isn't new. It's just an old vaccine that they've tinkered with. And we don't have polio. We don't have smallpox. And I'm a firm believer in getting vaccinated. Now, that being said, there were many days where the stress and the angst were like, you know, are we going to be able to make it? You know, we kept the pub open the whole time. Had 13 people on payroll just to do takeout. And it was a struggle. I mean, everybody was struggling. And there's that fear of getting sick. And the good news is, you know, we never had anybody that got sick. We never had to shut down because of COVID. You know, when we reopened the patio, you know, I've said it a number of times. I was like the COVID Nazi. You know, I literally had a 6-foot, 1x3 stick that I was measuring the distance between tables, and it was just totally, you know, you're not even thinking of coming in without a mask. And the host and the hostesses are cleaning the tables and the chairs. And, you know, at the end of the day, it paid off because people saw what we were doing, and it was big and wide open. But yeah, I'd be lying if I said there wasn't many nights that I'd go to sleep and go, what the hell is going on? And how are we going to be able to make it? But, you know, we survived.
Well, and now, as you talk about the pub and the pub state remained open, McGuigan's is going to undergo a little bit of a transformation by the end of this week. Am I wrong?
Well, let's hope it's by the end of this week. So, you know, the patio, when I built it and designed it, all the windows open. And, you know, it's like being in an outdoor patio on these nice days. Of course, these 95-degree days, we're not opening the windows, which is crazy. But it's 75 degrees in there. It's nice. So there are 6 windows in the pub. You know, we've been open 11 years there, and it's stationary windows, you know, like you would expect in any building. So I'm replacing those windows with the windows that open. So the windows along the front on Washington Street and the one window on the side on Legion Parkway are going to be taken out, replaced with a new, updated, ultra-modern version of windows that open. So the pub will also now have the ability to be open, and we're replacing, you know, on one side of the front are high tops. The other side is the pew and the big table, the pew that I took out of the church from across the street. We're gonna move that to the back of the building and replace that section with high tops. So that also will be pretty cool. And I'm hoping it's by the end of this week.
Are these going to be conventional windows that open outwards, or will they be motorized and kind of collapsible like you have for the patio?
They're not motorized, but they'll be just like the ones. They slide open sideways.
Okay.
You know, they're hinged, so they slide one side or the other, and, you know, the whole section will just be wide open. I think it will make a huge difference over there as well.
You think it'll become a trend in town to follow? You know, I mean, it's kind of a cool concept. And I've been in guilty pleasure, you know, going into the patio and finding, you know, I got a couple of different favorite spots there that I like to sit by the window when the window is open. You find that maybe we're going to see more and more businesses in town go with the open air type of model.
Yeah, I'm not sure that all businesses can do it. It would be difficult for some businesses to do it, and it's also very expensive. So do I think a lot of people will do it? Probably not.
Okay. Let's talk about the latest at McGuigan's besides modifications to the structure of the building itself. anything new in regards to the menus or anything that you're hoping to tease in the coming days and weeks?
Well, we might have talked about this before, but our lobster roll is back. And you know that we have a really, really good lobster roll. So that's back. We have a new beer that's coming on board this week. And it's a new IPA. It's made by Harpoon. And it's called Musa. MEW-S-A, and it's a citrus IPA. Hmm. It's a very limited production beer that we're fortunate enough to get quite a bit of it that we currently have. And again, it's going to go on sale probably tomorrow. And it has a picture of the Muir sisters from Hanson. Went to Whitman Hanson Regional High School. Sam was on the woman's World Cup soccer team, and both sisters are going to be in the Olympics, which is really, really cool. So somehow they've struck a deal with Harpoon, and they've produced a new beer, and it's been introduced, and we're going to start selling it, and we're looking forward to it very much. And of course, we have the Olympics coming up in a few weeks.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with the premier sponsor of Monday Night Talk, Richard Rosen, the proud proprietor of both McGuigan's Pub and the patio at McGuigan's, both located in Washington Street in downtown Whitman, historical downtown Whitman. I would probably want to kind of tease, if you don't mind, Richard, that brunch has returned to the patio. If folks are looking for a great spot, especially on a Sunday morning or early Sunday afternoon, great place to stop by and visit. That's my preference, but you could tease others.
So we brunch is back. You know, we had started brunch like a couple of weeks before the pandemic, and we stopped, obviously. And we've been back for 4 or 5 weeks doing brunch. We have an absolutely amazing Build Your Own Bloody Mary. That you pick your own vodka, you pick your own everything. We have little cards that we give you, and you check off if you want bacon or shrimp or a slider. They're pretty crazy.
It could be a meal in itself.
You know, I've seen people sit down and eat these things and then have breakfast. It's like, I'd have to go home after I drank or ate one of those Bloody Marys. So yeah, we're doing... Brunch is back. Brunch is good. We recommend reservations. And I'm not sure that you know that we had Phantom Gourmet came out, and we've done an episode that the whole episode has not aired yet. You know, we did the patio many years ago, and I'm sorry, we did the pub many years ago, and the patio. What they've been doing is they've kind of been teasing that as well. They've been running like a 45-second segment. When they talk about outdoor restaurants, and they kind of say it's not an outdoor restaurant, but it's not an indoor restaurant, and you get the best, and it's being touted as one of the best places on the South Shore to go, and it's being touted as one of the best brunches on the South Shore. So that's going to air soon. I know that every now and then they're running like a 45-second segment, but that will be on the air soon too.
Yeah, I believe Dan Adelman, if you go to Dan Adelman's, I don't know if he's got the Phantom Gourmet Facebook page or if it's on his personal, but I know the day that he was doing some of the shoots with his team that they were teasing the hell out of everything that you brought out of the kitchen and the establishment itself.
So the day that they did the filming, Dan Adelman actually did a live segment on Facebook. And our phone was ringing while he was doing the segment, which was amazing. And I think there was somewhere around 2,000, 3,000 viewers when he was doing it live in the restaurant. And since then, they put that thing out there. I think it had 69,000 views on his Facebook page, which is insane. I'm not on Facebook, so they tell me that's a crazy number. It sounds like a crazy number to me. You know, and I know that there was some talk about Phantom Gourmet is pay to play. It's not, you know, but that's what, you know, people do. You don't pay to go on Phantom Gourmet. You know, they find restaurants, they choose them, they pick you, you go on. But I'm really looking forward to it because it's great. It's great for the restaurants. It's great for Whitman. You know, it's just a good thing.
Could we talk a little bit about Ortiz, an upcoming event? We could get into it deeper when it draws closer. But one of the things that you have always been proud of are the different events that you can offer or the involvement of McGuigan's with the patio. And I believe you got the road race coming up in September.
So we had started last year to get ready for the road race, which we historically do in May. And of course, we had to cancel the road race because of COVID. Well, it's back. And this year it's going to be on September 26th, noontime, Sunday, September 26th. I think it's back and it's going to be a huge road race. Again, people are just looking for things to do and to get out. And they've been cooped up for 14 months, 15 months, and they want to get out. So we already have a great response. We just put it out like a week ago. You can go to either one of our websites and download the application. You can come into the restaurants and fill out an application. You can do it online, but we're looking forward to it. As you know, every penny of the funds that we raise goes to charity. And I'm very proud to say that we've given away about $45,000 over the years for this race, with half of it going to local food pantry. And we've given a lot to veterans organizations. We gave some money one year to the Boston One Fund. There's a whole, you know, local youth things and not just Whitman stuff. You know, we spread it around and, you know, it's our way of, you know, helping and making an impact. So, yeah, we're looking forward to the road race. It's always a great day. You know, we have a little block party afterwards. We have some local kids sing the national anthem, but there might be a few surprises this year, but very much looking forward to that on September 26th.
We just got a couple of moments left here in our segment. Anything we haven't touched upon, but you want to make sure that you mention before we say goodbye for this segment?
Well, I would ask that I come back soon and talk about some things that we might have coming up with respect to the Olympics. Nothing that I can talk about at the moment.
Yep.
And come back and talk about that.
And if folks want to place a reservation or they want to take a look at your menus, what's some of the best ways for folks to at least, you know, be ready to come into your restaurant and enjoy the experience?
So, yeah, the good question. The pub does not take reservations. The patio does, and I would suggest that people make reservations. So it's McGuigan'sPub.com for the pub, 781-447-7333, or the patio at McGuigan's, 781-447-2525. You can go to our websites, and we have Resy, R-E-S-Y, is the reservation system that we use at the patio, and it's been a lifesaver over there. You know, it's the restaurant gets full quickly, and you know, I hate to see when people get turned away at the door, but it's just one of those things that happens. So that's the way to reach out to both places.
And I would definitely suggest, if you haven't had a chance to stop by either McGuigan's Pub or the patio at McGuigan's, Now is the time to stop by and check out both of them. Whether it's on a nice, sunny 75, 80 degree day, popping by the patio and the windows are wide open, or just popping into the pub for a pint. You can't go wrong with either location. Once again, thank you for being a valuable supporter of this program and always taking time to talk about both of your investments.
It's my pleasure, Kevin, and thank you very much.
We will step aside. That's going to conclude our number one of Monday Night Talk. When we return, our number two. Don't go anywhere. You're tuned into Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD.
WATD FM Marshfield. WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
Plymouth 400 Inc. continues their mission of education and commemoration of the 400th anniversary of Plymouth's founding with a new television series called Plymouth 400 Conversations. The program will focus on authors, filmmakers, artists, and poets who discuss how the 400th anniversary commemoration influenced their work. Each episode premieres Thursday nights at 7:30 on PAC-TV, but available online for everyone to see the following day. Despite the pandemic, the 400th anniversary commemoration continues into 2021 with great virtual programming now, including this fascinating new virtual series, and live events later in the year. See what Plymouth 400 Inc. has scheduled. Shop for Plymouth 400 anniversary merchandise to share with friends and family, and catch the most recent episode of Plymouth 400 Conversations. Visit Plymouth400Inc.org.
You like my new car?
Well, I like that new car smell.
What is that infernal binging?
Oh, it's part of the driver assist. Standard equipment nowadays.
Assist?
Yeah, watch.
Hey, cut that. You're way too close.
Yeah, it's telling me that. See the text?
Watch out.
What was that?
You were driving too close. That truck snapped back a rock.
And now I have a cracked windshield?
You know, your mother was a way better driver assist.
Please, kindly check your windshield.
I'm Peter Brown from Tiny & Sons Glass. We replace your windshield and insurance pays. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call. And thank you.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Second hour of Monday Night Talk is upon us, and joining us for this segment is a gentleman who has been on his radio program many, many times. Actually, he's been on so many times, he still is a part of our opening intro. Former state representative serving the 7th Plymouth District. Last we heard from him, he was running for U.S. Senate. We have Jeff Deal joining us. He is a Republican candidate for governor right here in the Commonwealth. Jeff, how are you?
Great, Kevin. And let me try to reprise my intro, right? If it's Monday night, you got to be listening to Monday Night Talk. And by the way, if I can throw one more bone to your sponsors, Richie Rosen's Patio. My wife and I go there often after work or on the weekends to grab a drink and a great meal. So I'm glad they're a sponsor of yours. But thank you for having me on, Kevin.
Well, you know, the first thing, you know, that, you know, I thought of when I saw the press release last week was I've been expecting this. And I say I've been expecting this because from the first time that you and I have had conversations back as when you were running as state rep, then when you were able to become the state rep, you know, serving the folks in East Bridgewater, Abington, and Whitman, you have that timber that while you did a great job serving as a state representative and serving your constituents and a small part of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, I just feel as though you're somebody who has a greater good that you can serve than just, you know, 40,000 people.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it's funny, Kevin, as you're talking about it, it makes me go back to when I first got into office. One of the last things I expected to be dealing with was still the aftermath of the economic meltdown. And a lot of people were in foreclosure problems. I remember the floods of calls of people asking for help and intercession with their banks because of foreclosure. And we were able to help, you know, quite a number of people. At the same time, you still had soldiers coming back from serving overseas in the Middle East who were having issues either getting employment or they had medical needs that they were having trouble getting services for. So, you know, there was always a lot of work to do, and it was just a pleasure to work with the communities on things they needed. And so those things sort of kind of fall by the wayside when you end up talking about statewide or national issues down the road. But really, those were the things that were so exciting, was to be in three towns, Abington, Whitman, and East Bridgewater, and really get to know the residents, the people who are the community leaders, and figure out ways to plug them into the state services they needed. So, you know, thank you. It was a great time to be a state rep. And I think that for me, you know, taking a step towards U.S. Senate was certainly a way to get to know the entire state, the issues around the state. And now I think taking what I learned as state rep and that U.S. Senate run, I think I have the understanding, and I think they have the tools and the knowledge from both the private sector, where my wife and I own a small business, to the public sector where I served in office, where I can be an effective leader for the state out of the governor's office.
Was there a series of events or conversations that sparked your campaign for governor?
Well, you know, of course, when you run for U.S. Senate, a lot of people were disappointed that you don't win. But for me, it was sort of a chance to get back to putting my feet on the ground. I have a daughter who was heading off to college at the time, and my other daughter was, going into high school. And then the pandemic hit. And, you know, again, one of these things, it was the last thing you expect to happen. And, you know, immediately we saw businesses shut down. My wife and I had to close our studio, the Boss Academy of Performing Arts in Hanson. But she immediately, a week later, was able to get up and running with Zoom classes for kids for dance and acting and voice. So the private sector was very responsive to trying to figure out how to, you know, continue to live our daily lives or work lives anyway. The state really had a difficult time adapting. I know the school districts basically the first couple months back were online and really very hodgepodge at best. I mean, most of those kids ended up losing things like Whitman Hanson didn't have the graduation or prom or any of that stuff. And I understand, you know, the health concerns, but really there was very much an exposure of the fact that our education system in Massachusetts was completely unprepared to have to deal with remote learning or anything of this nature. So, you know, that was just sort of a wake-up call between education and the economy. By the way, most businesses were forced to shut down, but not a single state worker was furloughed or laid off. So they just continued on as if nothing was wrong. And we knew that, you know, economically, that's not going to work for the long haul. So, you know, we took a long time to come out of recovery. I think the pandemic sort of got me to thinking that maybe there was a better way to do things. And that's when other people were talking to me and saying, hey, look, you know, you ran for U.S. Senate. You certainly know how to run a campaign statewide. You know, we're together on a lot of these issues. Why don't we talk about running for governor? So we had the discussions, and ultimately, as you can tell, we decided to go forward with it. But it wasn't without, obviously, a lot of discussion with the family as well. I mean, still two kids that are, you know, in school age, and my wife and I, you know, still running that business. I work for another company as well. So it's a commitment of time away from family, but it's also a commitment for the state that we love, that we have given back to as best we can over the time. And we continue to feel like we've got something to give.
I'm going to come back to the small business in just a moment, but I want to get your thought on campaigning around the Commonwealth. You have done it a couple of different times, not only recently for U.S. Senate, but you had a highly successful campaign around the state for the ballot initiative, the gas tax. How do you feel about gaining that experience, and how is that going to help you this time around running for governor?
Well, that's a great point. You know, in 2014, I was in the legislature trying to push back on what then Governor Deval Patrick had passed in 2013, was this pretty intense tax package. He had included a tech tax, which was repealed 2 weeks later internally by the legislature because they realized it was a huge mistake. That, you know, they wanted to levy a new service tax on technology sector, which basically said, hey, you know what? We can take our computers, unplug them from Massachusetts, go to another state in a heartbeat, and you're going to lose billions in revenue over the years. So the state went, okay, you're right, mistake. But the other tax that we thought was a huge mistake was this indexing of the gas tax. They were going to basically make it so that everybody's gas tax would go up automatically every single year without a representative vote in the legislature. And their justification was that, you know, they had crumbling roads and bridges. Well, I hate to say it, but that's the argument every time they want to increase attacks on in transportation related. The fact of the matter is we were able to point out a lot of wasteful spending that was going on at the RMV, at the DOT, and the MBTA. I mean, there was really quite a bit of spending. And I think this has been my theme for a long time, is that government could be more efficient. Let's look for those efficiencies before we start trying to raise a tax on people. And by the way, the gas tax is the most regressive tax on households. Not only do you have to drive to and from work or get your kids to and from activities, but all the produce, all the things that you buy, the goods that you buy are transported by truck, usually at the last mile or so. And so therefore the increased cost there is going to go into your goods. And municipalities aren't exempt from the gas tax. So every police car, every fire truck, every school bus, all of those, the gas used there was going to go up and basically cause a property tax increase for you. So it really was a multiplier kind of tax. And we made the case in 2014. And, you know, statewide, it was eye-opening. You know, it's when you think it's a smallish kind of state, it's still pretty big state to drive around. And we went around everywhere we could, getting on every radio station that we could talk to, every TV station that would do an interview with me. You know, here I was at the time, just a state rep from Whitman, you know, and I'm trying to fight this massive gas tax, which Massachusetts, normally when they pass a tax, it's in there for good. So the feeling was that we were never going to be able to repeal this. And then the opponents, the people who benefit from spending, transportation spending, they were putting a kitty together of about $3 million against us for a campaign. So we were outspent by basically $3 million because we only raised a few hundred thousand for signs and banners and some ads here or there. But honestly, we were just scratching around and hoping that the word of mouth and the work I was doing basically to be a PR spokesman would at least resonate enough. And thankfully, the people of the state did agree with us, and we were able to win it by a fairly significant margin. I think it was 54%, which is basically an 8% margin. We actually outperformed Governor Baker in 2014 when he won the governorship. We got more votes than he did. And I know he at the time was a supporter of the gas tax being repealed, the indexing being repealed. So that was good. I don't know if you want to talk about this next, but the governor is now ironically taking a position of increasing our gas tax through this Transportation Climate Initiative, TCI.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, that was my segue. And again, we are speaking with Jeff Deal. He is a Republican candidate for governor here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I was going to say that right afterwards, that this current administration has signed on to the Transportation Climate Initiative. If you are elected, would you reverse the state's involvement in TCI?
Yeah, well, thankfully, we've only sort of signed on in a sort of an understanding, because the actual pact wouldn't go into effect until 2023. But the truth is that it was supposed to be a New England regional sort of understanding or pact that they would all sign on to this TCI initiative, which would basically create an unelected bureaucratic group that would determine a cap and trade on gas. And what that means is they would say that there's a certain amount of emissions, you know, that they would put a tax on. And basically the people who sold the energy, the gas stations, would pay that fee. Of course, they don't just absorb that fee. They pass it on to the consumer, the driver. So ultimately what would be happening was you would have an increase in the gas tax. People were predicting somewhere between 7 cents and 16 cents. But as I'd heard, it could be as high as 50 plus cents. So, you know, you don't know where the truth lies. The fact is, though, it was going to be an assessment that would increase the gas tax by a significant percentage. And the other ironic thing about the whole TCI plan was that it was supposed to reduce emissions. That's the goal. The Sierra Club came out recently and said they're not endorsing this TCI plan because the emissions reduction is negligible at best. They don't really see this as delivering on what it's promising. And I think because of that, you're seeing a lot of states. In fact, just about every New England state except Massachusetts is out. And the District of Columbia is the only other partner in this TCI tax. So basically what Governor Baker's still hanging on to is a plan to just create a new tax for Massachusetts and DC as well, and then sharing the revenue in that. It doesn't make sense to me. And again, we're also coming out of a pandemic where we're learning how to remotely commute to work, right? People are working from home more often. Our transportation emissions impact is down because of that. And I think that may be a future sort of baked into the way people go to work. They may be doing more remote work. So I don't think we necessarily have to fight what currently isn't happening anymore. And so there's a lot of factors that would say, yes, I'm not going to be going forward with TCI in 2023 if I'm successful in the race for governor.
You and your wife, Kathy Jo, you had mentioned it earlier. You are small business owners. And the pandemic had an effect on a lot of small and medium-sized businesses. Do you feel that the state government was unfair when it came to a lot of the regulations that it put in place during the pandemic? And what would you try to do to help small and medium businesses if you are elected? How important are they to the Deal administration?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, the SBA, if you look at the figures for the SBA, they say that small businesses are roughly, you know, 80 to 90% of most states' economy. I mean, there's not enough state or municipal jobs, you know, out there that people have. I mean, it's small businesses drive the economy. They drive innovation. They drive, you know, everything. So to me, you've got to take care of that first. They're the ones that provide the tax revenue for the state. So when they were shut down indiscriminately right at first, you know, it was hard for everybody to understand how are we going to be able to pay bills. You still have mortgages if you're a small business. You still have employees that you want to keep on payroll. You don't want to lose them. You know, do you lay them off temporarily? Do you lay them off or do the furloughs? What do you do? And there was very little guidance as to when things would reopen. We always thought it was going to be 2 weeks to slow the spread and then maybe we'd be back open. But we really weren't. And then what happened was you started to see some arbitrary rules, right? Big box stores like, Walmart and BJ's or Target were allowed to stay open. But, you know, and by the way, Stop and Shop, you know, thankfully some stores you needed were stayed open, but small mom and pop shops that offered the same thing were closed. And then when things like restaurants and bars tried to reopen, if you were a bar that served food, you couldn't reopen. But if you were a restaurant that served alcohol, you could, you know. Again, made the restaurant industry very upset because they really didn't understand. You had to have your mask on while you were sitting or while you were standing, but when you were sitting, you could take your mask off. I mean, really, it got to be a little bit hard to understand what was you could do and what you couldn't do. The other thing too was that a lot of people were trying to get back to work, and schools decided to reopen with a hybrid model where you'd have a cohort. Kids would go in 2 days a week, then they would be home for 3 days, and then the other cohort of kids would go in the other 2 days, and they'd be home for 3 days. So what happened was parents with multiple kids or just one kid, and they were trying to maybe get back to work if their job came back or if they were able to work, you know, through this pandemic, they didn't know how to basically deal with getting their kid online and to their classes each day while they, you know, at home while they were trying to get off to work if they could go in. So my wife and I, Kathy Jo and I, were able to open a learning pod with the studio. So during the day when our studio is not necessarily as active, we created the school hours, a learning pod. So kids from several towns in the South Shore came to our place, and we would have tables set up with internet access, and we would have lunch breaks and craft activities and outdoor activities when the weather was good. But mostly we were there to make sure that they would, you know, with their laptops that they brought, they could get online, and we would help steer them to their classes. And that's where we really saw also the difficulty with education get back up and running. A lot of districts had different platforms they used for kids to get online, and a lot of teachers had different skill sets when it came to those platforms. So some kids got more out of it, some kids got less out of it. It's very interesting to see teachers try to deliver content over a computer that they were normally doing in class. It was very difficult. So we were there to try to help for the, you know, I think it was about 6 months that we did it while schools were working towards full reopening. But it was rewarding. We certainly got a chance to, you know, listen to the parents, listen to the kids. And I think one of the positive takeaways, Kevin, that we have from this pandemic is that maybe school districts that are strapped for cash every now and again and can't afford teachers for certain types of classes, like let's say a foreign language class, they just feel like they can't afford another teacher for that language. Maybe what they can do now for the future is get those kids into a pooled class, remote learning class, right? Let them go online to a class that's conducted anywhere in the world, but they can join in and start learning that language. So if they can do it for the pandemic, let's see if we can deliver some more even education across the board in Massachusetts by doing remote classes where school districts might not necessarily have the resources for that dedicated teacher.
And if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with the former state representative, now a Republican candidate for governor, Jeff Deal, is my guest right here on Monday Night Talk, heard on 95.9 WATD. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think most of the people that you have come across during your time as an elected official and that you're probably going to encounter on the campaign trail, I think most common Joes, Bay State voters, concern themselves with taxes that they have to pay, funding education, and good roads and possibly sidewalks. What are your plans in regards to taxes, funding education, and any transportation infrastructure?
Yeah, well, first of all, I know here in the suburbs, you know, people think that you can just immediately do, you know, new developments and all that, but you've got to build a lot of that infrastructure to go with it. You've got to have roadways, sidewalks. You need public transportation sometimes because not everything extends from Brockton into, let's say, Hanson. So, you know, you're going to have those infrastructure investments. But, you know, the good news is there is always the money that comes in from the state to do those initiatives, and you get federal grants that are good. The thing I would say, though, generally speaking about taxes, is that we bring in the revenue that we need to operate in Massachusetts. In fact, ironically, right now, there's a tax surplus, even though the pandemic hit us. The state has more money that they collected this year than they expected to collect. So Governor Baker is thinking about turning around and putting that into a two-month sales tax holiday. I think that's another mistake. I think that we need to put that immediately back into the unemployment insurance trust fund, which was depleted, and it's completely in the red right now because obviously we've had massive payouts to people across the state when they weren't working. And so to take that money and put it into the trust fund would be, I think, a better way of using the revenue to help the small businesses and then protect us from future tax increases as well. There's also $5 billion coming from the federal government for recovery. I also argue that a lot of that should be going into the unemployment insurance as well before we start looking at spending on anything new. Let's get ourselves back on our feet fully. So it's always been a philosophy of mine that government needs to make sure what we're delivering is efficient. And, you know, I think there's improvements that we can make, you know, obviously in the way we spend our money in transportation. I think the RMV has had problems in the past. We saw that where they weren't able to process hundreds of out-of-state violations, traffic violations, which resulted in the death of seven Marines in New Hampshire. There was somebody whose license should have been pulled, and he ended up killing them in New Hampshire. Those are things where you also have to make sure that when you are spending your money, you're getting what you pay for, and that's quality people working in those state divisions. So for me, it's a review of what we're doing and how can we do it better. And then going forward, yes, how can we improve in the region? I mean, the good news is, like I said, when you've got things like the needs of having to replace the bridges going onto the Cape, now the federal government's gotten involved and we're going to get some help there. So, you know, overall, it's working with federal, state, and local partners to identify what's needed in the region and see if we can expand it. I know here on the South Shore, Kevin, we don't necessarily worry about internet connectivity, but in Western Massachusetts, it is a huge problem. You know, talk about kids not being able to go remote for classes out in Western Massachusetts. There's virtually no businesses out in, you know, the western part of the state because they don't know if they can depend on that internet connectivity. If we could just put what the basic wireless infrastructure out there that we have on the east coast of Massachusetts, we would open up a huge swath of development out in Western Massachusetts where there's plenty of land and obviously opportunities for people there to start working for companies that might want to relocate where they have more space and more affordable square footage. So I think there's also some investments we can make that are smart that will pay for themselves immediately. And to me, wireless infrastructure in Western Mass, it may not be tangible here in the eastern part of the state, but I think it helps alleviate a lot of the the inflationary cost that's going on here with the higher cost to just go into Boston, for example.
I have to ask you this, is when you took office back, 10, 11 years ago as a state representative, the state budget at that time was $28 billion. Right now, there's a negotiation going on for a $46 billion budget. It seems as though spending keeps continuously.
That's a 70% increase, Kevin. 70% increase in 10 years.
What can be done? What can be done to slow down this spending? Can anything be done?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You get up there and what you try to do is say, look, government doesn't need to come in and replace what the private sector is doing in a lot of ways. I know when the healthcare was taken over by the federal government, and then the state was Massachusetts was already a state that was where we were providing healthcare coverage. It was the right thing to do because, you know, you want to make sure that people who can't afford it are at least covered. But we've been doing that before the federal mandate came down. Once the federal mandate happened and in healthcare was required, all of a sudden the healthcare providers, whether it's doctors or medical, the people who make the medical devices or whatever it was, most medical services went up in cost because they knew government was the guaranteed payer. So a huge part of that increase over the last decade has been healthcare increased costs because we made government the payer. There's an attempt to continue to make government, you know, sort of guarantee student loans. And if government guarantees student loans, I can tell you that colleges will not lower their costs. They will continue to say, okay, great. The federal government's paying. We are going to increase these tuitions to an exorbitant rate because it's guaranteed to be paid by the government, even if the person defaults. So to me, reducing government's influence in what could and should be private sector free market, the free market principle that drives down cost, I think we need to reintroduce that in. I think we need transparency in healthcare again, where we can say, put a hip replacement, just to give you an example, put a hip replacement cost online. In Needham, it's going to cost X amount of money, but in Springfield, it'll cost X amount less. Are you willing to go here or there to get it? I think the free market is very good at figuring out ways to help drive down costs. And to me, that's one of the things we need to get done right away.
We just got a few minutes left in our conversation, and I want to thank you for making us, you know, Monday Night Talk one of your stops along the way. Many, many more conversations that you're going to have around the Commonwealth about your campaign. Is there a particular item or issue, and I'm sure there are going to be many issues that are going to be brought up while you're on the campaign trail, is there a particular issue or item that you want to take a moment to talk about that we haven't had a chance to talk about during our time together?
Well, I'm going to try to shoehorn two in, if that's okay, and I'll make it quick.
That's fine.
And that is, you know, first of all, support for law enforcement. You know, we see this continued national debate about defunding police, and it's trickled into Massachusetts. And I'm just hoping that whoever the candidates are for governor don't continue down this road of talking about, you know, defunding police or removing qualified immunity. Qualified immunity doesn't just affect police. It also affects firefighters. It affects EMTs. Anybody that's going out there and trying to do right by saving people's lives. If you remove qualified immunity, what you're doing is taking away that Good Samaritan sort of protection that they have. So I think that's a huge discussion that I want to have about supporting law enforcement and taking these terrible ideas about, you know, yes, there's bad apples, but you when you say that you paint the entire police force across the state, across the country, as, you know, not really being there for doing their job for the right reasons, you're creating problems that don't need to happen with people who are really going out of their way every day to protect us. So that's one discussion I think needs to continue to happen during this debate. The other thing is immigration. It's a federal problem, but it's a state problem too. It is a huge state problem because what we end up having is people who haven't been naturalized or processed, you know, living in the shadows, taking jobs under the table and, you know, collecting on state services. My goal, it has been always, is to try to speed up naturalization. I filed a bill when I was in the legislature to try to make sure that we could move people through the system faster, make sure that when they come here legally so that as soon as they become a natural citizen, they're eligible for all the jobs anybody else is eligible for driver's licenses, for anything and everything. Let them live the American dream. Let's just get them processed quickly so that they are legal. And then I think we reduce or remove this huge wedge between, you know, this huge debate that people have about immigration. It's not about not wanting people to come to the country. It's about having them come here legally. I think we can do, we can be a state solution for a national problem. That's my goal.
If folks want to get involved with your campaign, volunteer, if they want to donate or just learn more about you as a candidate, how can they do that?
Well, I know a lot of your listeners may already be aware of, you know, who I am and how I spell my name. It's Jeff Diehl, G-E-O-F-F-D-I-E-H-L. And the reason I say that is because my website is jeffdiehl.com. So www.geoffdiehl.com. And the website has a list of the issues that I think are important for this campaign. It's got, of course, a store where you can get bumper stickers and lawn signs and T-shirts and all that fun stuff. But it also has a place where you can sign up to volunteer so you can come to events, be a part of the team, and help spread the word about this campaign, because I'm excited. We are, you know, over a year away, but it's still a great chance for people to get to know me now before it gets really crazy. And then the final months, as campaigns always do, you know, this is a good summer to get to know me and what I'm about. So you can go there and find out where I'm going to be. So go to jeffdiehl.com if you want to learn more.
Here he is, a Jeff Diehl candidate, Republican candidate. Well, Governor Jeff, thank you again for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Kevin. I mean, first of all, I love getting back on with you again. It's great. It's like riding a horse. And secondly, hopefully we can take this ride a few more times before this is all over.
Indeed, we can. All right, we're going to step aside for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. Stay tuned. You are tuned in to 95.9 WATD.
Jay Farner here, CEO of Rocket Mortgage and Rocket Companies. Last year, we saw historically low mortgage interest rates. What you may not know is that interest rates are already starting to increase, and it's likely that trend is only going to continue. Our team of experts is standing by to help you save before rates go up. Don't look back and wish that you had taken action. Call 833-8-ROCKET or visit rocketmortgage.com.
Rocket.
Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states and MLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
This week's Pro Basketball Update brought to you by Credit Karma. We're into week two of the finals, and what a series it's been. East and West continue to collide, with Phoenix pushing the pace and Milwaukee playing that tough defense. Some experts say it could come down to which team can remain injury-free. The fans can't wait to see how it turns out. Right now, visit creditkarma.com/winmoney to open your free account and start winning. Instant karma. No purchase necessary. Exclusions and terms apply. See rules.
Hi, I'm Peter Brown. Today, I'm putting on my Lions hat. Today, we're going to talk about our annual solar plunge for the Plymouth Lions Club in Plymouth. It's on Sunday, July 18th, at the Plymouth American Legion, 199 Federal Furnace Road in Plymouth. Please help me raise money for the Plymouth Lions Club. This money goes to the local food banks and community needs. Our team is called Tiny's Tubers. Yes, it is Tiny's Tubers. Please go to PlymouthLions.org and click on the link for the solar plunge. Here's how you donate. You can either click on and donate there, or you can make a general donation to the Solar Plunge Challenge. Just text 2021 to this phone number, 855-731-9434, and follow the link to donate. Donate a lot. I'm trying to beat Kevin Gallerani. And thank you.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We have arrived at the final segment of Monday Night Talk, heard right here on 95.9 WATD. Our final guest for this evening is Mr. Mike Festa. He is the AARP Massachusetts State Director. He's here to discuss a new study that documents the financial strain on family caregivers and a recently introduced Credit Caring Act that would provide a tax credit of up to $5,000 to those who are eligible. Mike, thank you for joining us and welcome to the program.
Kevin, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your program and to talk about what I think a lot of folks, your listeners, are going to appreciate, because we're focused on supporting caregivers, and there are a lot of them in Massachusetts, that's for sure.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with AARP.
Sure. Well, I I'm an attorney, and for many, many years I served in the House of Representatives, actually in Massachusetts, representing the north of Boston district, Melrose, Stoneham, Wakefield. And then I served as the Secretary of Elder Affairs under Governor Deval Patrick for a period of time. I joined AARP as the state director about 8.5 years ago now. So I'm firmly ensconced in the world of AARP. And in many ways, in my background, I've done a lot of work as a legislator, certainly focused on senior related issues, people 50 plus generally. But certainly along the way, getting to know caregivers, understanding and appreciating the challenges that are presented. And then, of course, with the pandemic exacerbating a lot of those conditions that I'm sure we'll talk about in this interview.
Just so everybody knows what the definition is, what is a family caregiver and what is it that they do?
Well, let's start with acknowledging that caregivers are essentially family members, but they can also be friends and even neighbors in some cases. But they're providing help of some sort to a loved one or someone close to them. It's usually a parent or a spouse or a sibling. And what we're talking about here are the kinds of things that, you know, kind of common sense. It's going out, getting the groceries, helping around the house, helping with personal care issues, dealing with mobility issues, cooking, cleaning, et cetera. So it can, in some cases, be fairly complex, actually. I mean, we know one of the other studies we've done earlier, which, you know, essentially is part of what we're now going to be talking about. But historically, one of the things that I thought we found the AARP found was really extraordinary is that many of our caregivers are providing what I would characterize as pretty complicated, complex medical care. We're talking about, you know, putting in the insulin in and dealing with PICCs, the needles and, you know, and things of that nature. And I would tell you that one of the concerns we've had on that score is that, you know, frankly, there's not a lot of training. One of the bills that passed years ago was to support the training of those who are asked to take care of a loved one leaving the hospital. And there's actually a law in Massachusetts that requires that before you get discharged, a loved one leaves the hospital and goes back to home, that designated caregiver, this is a voluntary thing, but the designated caregiver would be receiving some hands-on training just so they'll know when they go back home, you know, what to do in these complicated cases. So caregivers come from, you know, every generation too. I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge that the loved one that's being cared for could very well be a younger person, right? Someone with complex medical needs, mobility issues, what have you. But the ones who are providing the care, you know, can be as old as those in the silent generation, you know, 60, 70s, 80s. And then, of course, younger people, the children of those who are being cared for, et cetera. So they're of many ages. The common denominator, frankly, is that they want to help and they do help someone else to improve the quality of their life.
Let's talk a little bit about whether it's the genesis of the study or what it basically was able to uncover when it comes to the financial strains of being that family caregiver.
Yeah. Well, you know, this may be a surprise to your listeners, but the study showed that almost 80% of the people who are caregivers are actually spending out-of-pocket money of their own to help that caregiver. And what's even more, I think, compelling when you think about what those numbers look like is that the average caregiver is spending well over $7,000 a year to support a loved one or someone that they're caring for. And the studies have shown that, and this particular study showed that of that amount of money, that's approximating 25% plus of their actual household income. So it's a big deal when it comes to the actual costs and the impact it has. And I'm sure that there are many people who are listening, Kevin, that they themselves are caregivers. So a lot of what we're talking about rings true with them, I'm sure, because they are experiencing some of the challenges that we uncovered in this study.
I find it interesting that until our conversation here, I'm not aware of any other ways to assist caregivers. Mm. Can something actually be done to help those caregivers in need?
Well, that's the very critical question, right? And I will tell you that there's actually, we're focused now on a federal remedy, is what I would call it. It's called the Credit for Caring Act. It's something that is currently pending in the United States Congress. It's a bipartisan bill that essentially addresses this challenge by acknowledging, number one, that yes, caregivers are laying out serious money to support a loved one. And what we're trying to do, what they are seeking to do with this bill, is to provide up to $5,000 of a tax credit, which essentially would be used to help offset a significant amount of those expenses. And, their AARP, of course, is strongly supporting this bill. We know how important this is for family caregivers. And what I'm happy to tell you is that two things that are important to acknowledge. Number one is there are a lot of other organizations across the country that have joined forces to support the act. There's over 80 organizations that are currently advocating, as we are, to make this happen. The other thing is that we have in Massachusetts, where we're talking, an extraordinary delegation that have historically been very supportive of AARP issues, this being one of them. So we've got 9 congresspeople, we've got 2 United States senators, and we have a unanimous view of our delegation that this makes sense to them as well. Many of our delegation are actually co-sponsors of the act. So that's what this is about. I do want to make a quick point, Kevin. We don't have to explore it too deeply, but we are also in Massachusetts fighting for a state-based caregiver tax credit. Nice. It's up to $1,500, and it is something that is pending in the current legislative session. We are cautiously optimistic. We've gotten good support in the legislature in the past, but always getting it across the finish line is a challenge. So I just wanted to make that known to your listeners as well, that we're working on it at a state level as well.
Yeah, and if you don't mind me following up on that, it being a former legislator and somebody who set policy, how good is it to have bipartisan support, have several organizations that are backing this? Do you feel that it stands a good chance of being, signed into law, that it'll be accepted?
I actually do. I mean, I realize that most everyone acknowledges that the conditions in Washington with regard to partisanship are really hyper and not good, generally speaking. But there are areas of policy where I think it is fair to say that it cuts across all points of view. And many of those who support the Credit for Caring Act are, conservative Republicans, liberal Democrats, and everywhere in between. Because, let's face it, we're talking 48 million people who are caregivers around the country. That's a lot of voters. That's a lot of people, constituents, that our congresspeople care about. Secondly, this is, there's nothing partisan about it, right? This is about acknowledging that for the sake of the families that are being able to help a loved ones, keep them at home longer, that is something that I think is universally felt as a critical need and a societal need. And it also, I think, needs to be pointed out that God forbid, if you think about it, imagine if we didn't have family caregivers of the nature we have, where would those loved ones be going? A lot of them would be driven into very unfortunate, costly alternatives, nursing homes, long-term care facilities, and which is not to say that they're bad inherently, but most people, in fact, the vast majority of people really want to stay in their home as long as possible. And so if you've got a caring person that wants to be helpful to keep you in that home longer, from a policy point of view, from a societal point of view, it makes perfect sense to acknowledge their critical role And on a financial, you know, frankly, to help taxpayers, the more people are staying home longer means less people hitting that system where it costs, you know, between $10,000 and $15,000 a month to keep someone in a nursing home. So it makes sense for a lot of reasons. And I would say one other thing, which is that when it comes to the bipartisan approach, this is the AARP MO. I mean, we are, frankly, I think the strongest lobbyist group for older persons in this country. We have historically been, you know, very strong, you know, very engaged, obviously, in supporting Social Security solvency, fighting for Medicare, protecting older folks in a variety of ways. So this is our bread and butter work. But everything we do, we always promote a bipartisan approach because we recognize that, number one, as an organization, we are nonpartisan and we don't, you know, we're not giving money to candidates. We're not endorsing candidates. We are focused on the issue. And so if a person who's running for office is with us on the issue, that's where we will share that information with our members. So it's all about being bipartisan. It's all about acknowledging, in this case, with the Credit for Care Act, we have a lot of an impetus to get the bill passed. And I would make one last point, Kevin. I apologize for going too long, but I wanted to be sure to cover the fact that there is a lot happening in Washington when it comes to supporting caregivers and home and community-based care generally. The Biden administration, as most of your listeners may be aware, they're doing an initiative to expand long-term care options, support for long-term care. It's the personal infrastructure that the president and some of his cabinet have been talking about. And while that is, it clearly has a tough road to hoe because there's a lot of money involved, I think similar to the Credit for Caring Act, it all boils down to acknowledging that we are in a world where, you know, caregivers and cared for people really need the support of government to ensure that this can continue. And this credit is obviously going to make a big difference for people's pocketbooks.
And if you are just joining our conversation, we're speaking with Mike Festa. He is the AARP Massachusetts State Director, and we're talking about the Credit Caring Act that is currently being worked on federally, but he's also, in a previous answer, mentioned that there is some legislation that is in the works here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So it's kind of a two-pronged attack or two-pronged approach to helping those caregivers. You know, we're on the other side of dealing with a global pandemic. I don't know if we're necessarily out of the woods, but could you kind of talk a little bit how family givers have been affected in regards to COVID and when it hit?
Yeah. Well, you know, Kevin, I think that the first thing that has to be said is that even if you are not a caregiver, experiencing the kind of isolation from other neighbors, friends, workers, co-workers, it's really hit all of us in one way or another in a negative way. It's an emotionally very draining situation. We're coming out of it. Massachusetts, we're fortunate that we have a high percentage of those vaccinated. So I think that yesterday there was 90-something people in the whole state that caught COVID. So we're in a good position. However, you know, not to get too negative about it, we also are in a position where people are now talking about variants, Delta variant and other variants that may indeed recycle into environments. Certainly in some parts of the country, there's a real problem with the percentage of people vaccinated. So it's an ongoing challenge. But here's the fundamental point. Because of the pandemic, I think we have found, again, as a society, as a community, that there is a full appreciation for what caregivers have gone through before the pandemic, during the pandemic, and now coming out of the pandemic. This has really highlighted the challenges because, again, one of the things that is you know, is true is that when you don't have, if you think about the world around us, most communities have a senior center. Most communities have adult day programs where you can have your loved one dropped off for the day to engage with other seniors, have activities, you know, socialization, et cetera. A lot of those things just shut down completely. In fact, in some communities, they're still shut down. And so it put even more focus and more pressure, frankly, on caregivers to maintain a quality of life in a circumstance where they really didn't have a lot of resources to call upon except their own, which again goes back to the original point, which is the Credit for Caring Act is a financial remedy, but it's an acknowledgement of the critical role that these family caregivers are playing, and the government essentially saying, you know, but for you, it would have been a lot worse for these individuals, but also just collectively, it would have been a much tougher situation for, you know, long care facilities. So we've got to do what we can to be helpful. And, you know, by the way, on the statistics, one other statistic that I think is really important, a lot of this is in the context of people trying to maintain employment. They here's a caregiver who, you know, mom's now home, they're home because their job has maybe they lost their job because of the pandemic. So there's even more, you know, time, and that's good for the loved one. But that's also putting more pressure on them financially. So there's a whole series of challenges that we're dealing with. And we at AARP are saying, you know, we've got to support our caregivers. We've got to acknowledge the challenges they face. And when it comes to the amount of care, our study showed that about 32% of family caregivers are providing at least 21 hours of care a week. So we're talking serious time. And that's time that, you know, frankly, impacts your ability to go back into the workforce. And obviously, we know that there are other employment-related challenges caused by the pandemic. So it's a perfect storm of challenge. And this is why the remedy that we've been fighting for here and talking about today is so important.
Is it worth noting? I don't know if you know the language in regards to this act. Do we know if this is going to be an annual tax credit, and would this?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. This would be an annual tax credit, and it would be based on, you know, what the previous year's expenses were. And the again, the tax credit would be up to $5,000. And it's a credit. It means that, you know, even if you have no income, it's money that the government would send to you. And by the way, I know we want to talk about this too, Kevin. It's important, frankly, to talk about the disparate impact on different communities.
Sure. And I was actually going to say, we've kind of taken a blanket approach. I definitely want to dissect this a little bit more, if you will.
Exactly.
Talk about the different groups that are actually hardest hit financially.
Yeah. So first, what I think is amazing and chilling in some respects is that when we did our study, we broke it down and we looked at the Hispanic Latino communities. We looked at the African American, Black American communities. White and Asian. So you pretty much look at all the demographics. And what we found is that Hispanic, Latino, and Black Americans, on average, they're spending 47% of their income on caregiving and expenses for Latinos. Let me be clear. Latinos were in worst shape financially. 47% household income spent on caregivers, followed by African-American, Black Americans, which on average were spending 34% of their income on caregivers. And those numbers are big numbers. We're talking about, you know, $10,000 plus in many cases. So the impact is really, really borne out with those communities of color and Hispanic communities. And so as we fight to get this passed, we are very mindful of the disparities and the inequities in the system and in the society. And so we know that this will lift all boats, but most assuredly it will make it even more critically important, and it is more critically important for those in communities, minority communities that really have been struggling. And, you know, for Gen X folks, you know, when you break it down from age, they're spending, remember now, the overall average cost out of pocket, $7,200. For Gen X caregivers, it's like $8,500. And for working caregivers, I mean, this is the other thing too. You have that category of people who are either not working and are taking care of a loved one, but there are many, of course, who are working. And that is another big impact. We talked about it briefly, but we broke it out. The study focused on people who are working and caregiving. And we found that they're spending $10,200 plus on average, which is almost twice as much as caregivers who don't have work-related strains and challenges. So it's a, you know, in many respects, this is a really dire situation. It's a very challenging one. And people with dementia, people with Alzheimer's, the average, the study showed the average was close to $9,000 a year in out-of-pocket costs. So no matter how you analyze the data, the bottom line for the average caregiver is that people are spending a lot of money out of their pocket, and it's really important for the government to not only acknowledge that, but to do something about it. And that's why the current Credit for Caring Act is so important to AARP as an advocacy group, but frankly, to everyone who is a caregiver and who is concerned about this.
You are just tuning in. We are speaking with Mike Festa. He is the AARP Massachusetts State Director, and we're talking about the cost of caregiving, a new study that has been conducted about the financial strains, and AARP's endorsement of tax credits. I believe this is called the Credit Caring Act that is being worked on the federal level. We just got a couple of minutes left with you, Mike.
Sure.
And if you would be kind enough to share a little advice that maybe you could provide to the caregivers, or even tell them what resources AARP could offer them for help.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Let me start by saying that a lot of what we've talked about, you know, is obviously in some respects technical, and there's a lot of information. And what I'm going to suggest to folks who are listening in is that at your leisure, if you want, you can go on AARP's website. It's aarp.org, and then you put /caregiving. That's the category, caregiving. And when you get on our website, you will find a wealth of information and resources that can connect you and provide you with what we think will be very helpful if you are a caregiver or the one being cared for. Who would like to be helpful to their caregiver and so get that information. And I would say that we'll probably mention this one more time before we do the wrap, Kevin, but suffice to say, no matter when, what time of day or what day, you know, you're thinking about this, you can always go on that website and you're going to get a lot of information. The other thing I would say is that it is really important to acknowledge that we're in the middle of this political, you know, sort of a calendar, and a lot of the effort you know, that we encourage people personally, frankly, is to share your concerns with your local state legislator, as well as your, you know, your United States congressperson or senator, because they need to hear from you. The good news, as I said before, in Massachusetts, we have a delegation that's very supportive of caregivers in general, and in particular the Credit for Caring Act. But I think even for those who support it, it's nice to hear that from constituents. So that's another thing that's not a bad idea, as far as I can see. And again, to remind everybody, the way this works is that you spend money on caregiving, you keep your receipts. It's just, you know, when you think about taxes, you're always looking at documenting, you know, whatever your filing is going to be. But in the case of a credit that you're seeking, add up your bills, and that's where you're going to be putting that information if it turns out to be a new law that hopefully gets passed. And you can then, up to $5,000, get a credit for the money you've paid out of pocket. So that's what we're fighting for. It's not yet the law, but hopefully because of programs like yours, Kevin, where we can talk about this and make people more aware of it, that more and more congresspeople are going to get the message that we've got to get this passed now, because this is a critical time for a lot of caregivers, and they really could use the financial support.
In our closing minute here, anything that we haven't touched upon or anything that you want to say to close out this segment that we've had together?
Well, Kevin, thank you first and foremost for the opportunity to talk about these this issue. I just want to remind the listeners, as I said a moment ago, if you want to get more information about how caregivers can be supported, and if you are a caregiver and you're trying to find get resources, both local and national resources, go to aarp.org/caregiving, and you'll get all that information right off, you know, from at your convenience. And so last thing I want to say is this: caregiving is a big part of our world, our society, our community. And we applaud each and every caregiver who are spending. There are 840,000 caregivers just in Massachusetts. Thanks to each and every one of them for doing your part in helping your loved ones stay at home longer. We applaud you, and we're fighting for you, and we hope at AARP that this law gets passed so things can be better for you.
We have been speaking with Mike Festa. He is the AARP Massachusetts State Director. Mike, once again, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Kevin. Thank you very much, and have a great summer.
And that will do it for tonight's program. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., thank you for tuning in to Monday Night Talk. Have yourself a great night.